District of Conservation is sponsored by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, better known as CFECT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to CFECT.org. Thanks for listening to the program.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. I've got a special Tuesday roundup across some interesting policy and cultural updates that relate to conservation, energy, environment issues. I'm going to briefly touch upon the potential massacre of 500,000 barred owls in the Pacific Northwest, and if they are truly invasive as the Fish and Wildlife Service has deemed them to be. I want to talk about this new Lincoln project for EV adoption to get Republicans interested in EVs and why that sounds extremely far-fetched. And we'll talk briefly about why EVs are actually starting to be opposed by people all across the political spectrum, not just Republicans and even independents. And then we're going to round out with this very interesting clickbaity story you may have seen me post on social media about using genes and why your gene usage, even after one use, is bad for the environment. And we'll talk a little bit about fast fashion. I think you could draw awareness to fast fashion without saying give up all your stuff. And we're going to talk about why you don't need to make sacrifices if you care about the planet. So let's dive deep into this roundup. Back in November, the Fish and Wildlife Service had put out a proposal soliciting comments, a draft environmental impact statement for the barred owl management going on there across Washington, Oregon, and California. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has determined that this particular owl, which is native to the eastern United States, but has made its way across the United States all over to the West Coast, Pacific Northwest. And I had heard from some people native to the region who said that it took a while and they were actually relieved that the Fish and Wildlife Service had labeled them invasive. We're going to debate if they're truly invasive species, but according to their press release dated November 8th, they believe that this EIS will be a management strategy needed to protect northern and California spotted owls from extinction. And if you're from the West Coast like me, you will have all heard about spotted owls and how environmentalists and regulators had prioritized the spotted owl over industrial interests or logging interests and how it actually led to the decimation of that industry and economic downturns and so forth, and how you didn't necessarily have to sacrifice one versus the other. But that's what they did. They put the spotted owl over logging interests, and now that region is hard hit for many reasons. But going back to this, why this agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, wants to do this. Populations of northern spotted owl, which are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, are rapidly declining due to habitat loss and competition with barred owls. Based on recent analysis, northern spotted owl populations in study areas throughout their range declined by 35% to more than 80% over the past two decades. This is even with protections, ESA protections, and canceling logging operations mostly throughout this region. California spotted owls, which the service proposed for ESA listing earlier this year, face a similar risk from barred owl competition as barred owl populations continue to expand southward. They also write in this press release that barred owls are generalist predators and opportunistic hunters, eating almost any species they encounter, including small mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, fish, earthworms, snails, slugs, insects, and crayfish. They have invaded western forests from their historic range in eastern North America, threatening the long-term survival of spotted owls and impacting a variety of native wildlife species that either prey for or compete with barred owls for the same food resources. I want to read for you this really good column from Bonner Cohen, who works very closely with CFACT, who sponsors the podcast. And I really was fascinated by his take because it seems like a reasonable take. And it's in the Washington Times and it's titled, "Will the Feds Decimate One Owl Species to Help Another?" So he talks about the EIS, what they're proposing, and explores what it is. But what a lot of people don't understand is this barred owl is currently protected by the Migratory Bird Act Treaty, and killing them, as Bonner writes, by the hundreds of thousands will require a federal permit or take permit or regulation. And that is what the Fish and Wildlife Service appears to be inclined to do. And he goes on to say that they have been migrating because, if you all know, you don't need to be a biologist, wildlife biologist even, to know birds migrate. They don't stay in one place. I've had barred owls outside my backyard making mating calls. And it sounds like, you know, a jackal or something kind of crazy, but these are owls that are making the noise. So we see them here in the eastern United States, and they're a cool bird. But there are, if we're thinking about competing birds displacing each other from the landscape, we have bald eagles here. We have different birds of prey. We have different owls. We have red hawks. We have so many different hawks. We have red foxes, coyotes. Are they displacing each other? Are they considered invasive? I mean, there is management needed, especially for foxes and coyotes, of course, in increasingly urban areas. But it's funny, you don't see here on the eastern United States birds that could, if I'm understanding correctly, predators that can outcompete with one another, if I'm understanding correctly and if I recall, eagles can eat owls too, right? I think that's not out of the realm of possibility. So why is it that the barred owl is getting special attention for the spotted owl in terms of preferencing one versus the other, even though all these protections on the spotted owl are largely there? Why haven't they improved? This goes to the question also of, is the ESA working? Is the Endangered Species Act working to protect imperiled birds? Do we have to displace industries to safeguard protections for birds? We can argue that that's not necessarily needed. You don't have to sacrifice one versus the other. So now we have this same thing happening again. And as Bonner says, when the problem first garnered attention in the early 1990s, the preferred explanation from the Fish and Wildlife Service and environmental groups was that of commercial logging of old growth forests being responsible for the loss of the northern spotted owl's habitat and thus was behind the bird's dwindling numbers. Saving old growth forests, where Douglas fir and hemlock prevail, was seen as by the Clinton administration as the preferred solution, and policies were put into place to restrict logging on federal land in the Pacific Northwest. Those policies succeeded in shutting down many sawmills and destroying timber-dependent communities throughout the region. And as Bonner Cohen notes as well, the Clinton administration even orchestrated an owl summit at which federal officials and environmentalists congratulated themselves for caring so much about the fate of the northern spotted owl. Those who pointed out that the problem lay not with old-growth forests, but with the encroaching barred owl were ignored. Over 30 years after the summit and the birds being added to the endangered species list, the situation faced by the northern spotted owl has worsened. So again, this conversation is ESA protection helping this imperiled bird. I had talked about the ESA at 50 and read that report, and I actually met one of the foremost people, reformers of the ESA, and he has said that actually the law leaves imperiled species a lot worse off. It doesn't help them whatsoever. And that could be an argument that we can make here. Why have federal protections increased, but their situation and their status has only worsened? That beckons to be questioned and beckons to be discussed. And as he continues, they actually so far have experimented with the lethal killing of almost 2,500 barred owls with 12-gauge shotguns in 5 areas in the region. And they have said that nonviolent removal or non-lethal removal of barred owls was impractical. So they're now settling on a lethal approach. This means showing a preference for one species of owl over another, with the so-called invasive barred owl coming up short. But is the barred owl, as Bonner Cohen is noting here in his article, really an invasive species, or is it simply expanding its territory, as many species of birds and mammals are prone to do? He cites a group called the Owl Research Institute, a Montana-based nonprofit focused on owl conservation, who is reviewing the government's proposal. And he cites a quote from a statement the institute gave to McClatchy News saying, quote, "Central to this discussion is the determination of whether barred owls truly meet the criteria for an invasive species or if they represent a more adaptable species capable of natural expansion by themselves, as some have suggested." So this is also
kind of related to discussion. I've heard debate over, let's think of context closer to home here in the mid-Atlantic. We have heard about and have been alerted to the fact that the snakehead, a fish introduced illegally by people, usually foreigners, into the country, into our bodies of water. I've seen mixed reviews as to whether or not that fully decimates native species. There, early on, I had heard that the presence of snakehead actually did jeopardize and threaten other species. And then I've also heard other reports where the snakehead has learned to coexist with bass, catfish, and other species. There's debate over that. So with respect to invasive species, in terms of being highly adaptable, and if something is truly invasive, although the snakehead, don't get me wrong, is still highly invasive, but I'm trying to say that there has been cases where so-called invasive species do adapt, and then they don't pose a threat after a certain point, if I'm understanding this correctly. But again, there's still longstanding debate over this. So is the questions you want to ask yourself, even if you don't live in the Pacific Northwest, and most of you listening to the show live here on the East Coast, in the South, some of you do live out West, but we have to debate, is this really a sustainable thing to massacre 500,000 barred owls? Are they truly invasive, or are they just highly adaptable? And I find myself in rare agreement with the preservationists I largely lambast, because I just don't see how this is practical. Give me a reason to believe that this is practical and that this will help save the spotted owl. But they've tried this before. They've shut down industries. So what if you kill 500,000 barred owls and there's no impact and the spotted owl situation worsens? These people, especially preservationists, and it's not surprising that this is both, previously it was under a Democratic administration, now we have the same Democratic administration that's even more preservationist deciding this policy. So I have a lot of questions. I thought this story was super interesting. And if they proceed with this, Lord help them. They're going to be facing a lot of questions from their typical preservationist backers. And I really don't think this is a feasible solution, practical solution. Again, you stopped entire industries at the behest of the spotted owl. You kill a competing species. What if another species overruns the region and they say, we got to manage this as well? So there seems to be no end here. Again, this also puts into question about ESA reforms. So we will ponder this more and keep you updated if this plan is to proceed. Let's talk about this effort. I hate to bring in politics to the show, and you all know where I stand politically. I'm a conservative. I am very proud about that. I sometimes criticize my side when I feel that they're insufficient on true conservation efforts, but you should know where I stand politically. So when I saw my friend Matthew Whitlock post this crazy article about the push to make EVs more amenable to Republicans, and I want to break this down very simply for you all and say that even though I've come out strongly against EV mandates, I think if you want to buy an EV, a Tesla, a hybrid, what have you, do it on your own accord. If you can afford it, great, do it. You take advantage of a subsidy, I may question you and have a different opinion of you. I don't think the government should be subsidizing these cars, giving preference to one type of vehicle over another, picking winners and losers. And for the most part, those who take advantage of a subsidy are typically people who can already afford it, those making over $100,000. So you're subsidizing wealthy people to allow them to purchase luxury cars. And those who are lower middle income will never see that subsidy, nor they should, because it's a complete gimmick. It's not a good program. Subsidies exacerbate problems, and even a subsidy is not enticing to people to buy electric vehicles. You don't see people rushing to buy EVs, even with the $7,500 credit, which is not very different from the original $7,500 credit we saw under the Obama administration. But anyway, now we see this article in Politico. I do not know who Mike Murphy is. He claims to be a veteran GOP consultant and the founder of EVRepublicans.org. This is a new group, and as Matt Whitlock talked about greatly, I really loved his point. He said on April 7th that they made a Lincoln project for electric cars. I would have loved to have been in the boardroom when the EV people were like, quote, how do we get Republicans to buy our cars, end quote. And some Democrat was like, hire one of those former Republicans who hates them now. And I think this Mike Murphy guy probably fits that. And he says the attacks on EVs in Politico have become perverse in the GOP, led by former President Donald Trump, whose inflammatory warning about a bloodbath last month if he loses the election was actually part of a tirade against the Biden administration's push for EVs. To try to cut through the noise, I set up the EV Politics Project earlier this year with GOP pollster Dr. David Hill. I've worked in GOP politics, conservative movement For over a decade, never heard of these guys. And we immediately took a national poll to get a sense of the politics surrounding the EV issue. They claimed, he writes, that we surveyed 600 voters across the U.S. with income households of $50,000 a year or above, so we could zero in on the new car market. Our survey reflects a demographic that represents about two-thirds of likely 2024 presidential electorate and nearly all U.S. new car buyers. First, we asked voters if they had a mostly favorable mix or mostly unfavorable view of American car brands. On this topic, Republicans and Democrats were in lockstep. Republicans rated American car brands 59% more favorably than Democrats, while Democrats rated them 55% mostly favorable. When we asked voters to rate electric car brands, the partisan divide was stark. GOP voters gave electric cars a net 40% unfavorable rating, while Democrats gave EV brands 15% net favorable rating. That's a huge 55-point gap between Republicans and Democrats. Why such Republican hostility towards electric cars? It's tribal. In our modern politics, any friend of my enemy must be my enemy too. And I usually dislike the contrarian stuff. If Joe Biden is for EVs, we must be against them. I don't see that to be the case. Okay, now that we've read a little bit of this, and I want you to read the article for yourself, because again, I've worked in politics. I can tell you anecdotally, I've never heard of these people, and I'm pretty well connected all across the board. Now let's bring into the conversation what EV mandates are and if people are rushing to buy it. So if you look at several polls that have been put out, published within the last year, I'm going to cite more specifically an Ipsos poll. I think there was a Gallup poll, Pew Research poll, but there have been several polls done by very serious pollsters who don't lean to the right. Let's say that. Every one of them has said that most Americans, and primarily Republicans and independents, when given a choice, and then also if they're told to buy an EV, you compel fewer people across partisan lines to buy EVs when it's a mandate. But even with the so-called incentives, the EV subsidies, and then the threat of manufacturers will have to produce fewer internal combustion engine models and then make way for more EV models, you don't think that's a mandate. That is, because manufacturers are being mandated, you have to accord yourselves to these standards by arbitrary deadlines. That's what the new EV mandate for light duty cars is. And same with the heavy duty trucks. We had twin rules come out about passenger cars and also trucks. But back to these polls, and you can read these polls for yourselves. But they're very serious polls that have been conducted, and they polled American attitudes on EV adoption. Majority of respondents said they will never in their life ever consider an EV or are very reticent or hesitant to even consider it. 50% in one poll. And I believe it was similarly 50% and higher. I think it was 63% in another poll said that I will never consider a car or most likely never buy an EV vehicle. And those polls speak for themselves. So I don't see where you can put this contrarian thing that, well, because Biden supports EVs, we have to oppose it. I think that's very little. Certainly some people may frame it like that, but I think it goes on even beyond Republican opposition. You see independents and even a growing share of Democrats who, when told they have to be mandated to convert their choice from a reliable gas-powered car to an unknown to a virtually good-sounding car but has lots of troubling factors like a limited range, perhaps a worse environmental footprint, and whatnot, more and more people who are not Republicans also indicate in public opinion polls that they don't want them either. It's not a Republican thing, opposition to EVs. Certainly Republicans are leading the efforts to oppose EVs because they see that it's a mandate, that it's being forced, and that even if you offer carve-outs and subsidies and this, it doesn't reduce the price. And the true cost of EVs, according to the Texas Public Policy Foundation, you take out those so-called subsidies from the equation, it's $50,000 as a base rate for a conventional EV car. So what are you saving? You're better off with a conventional car. But they're trying to squeeze consumers through mandates, indirectly through the manufacturers by demanding that they produce fewer models so that those burdens and costs, increased costs, are going to be translated down to us, the consumer. This is how economics works. You suppress one chain of command in the economy, that's going to be trickled down to the rest of us. This is basic economics. You don't need to be an economist to know this. But if one sector of the economy is going to be constricted. The producers are going to be constricted. How are the consumers not going to feel this? Of course we're going to feel this because regulations trickle down. So EV opposition is not a partisan issue. Like I said, it's becoming increasingly nonpartisan and even bipartisan. So this group seems extremely questionable to me, and I am thankful to Matt Whitlock for putting this on my radar, and we're going to expose them. And like I said, these sound like obscure Republican figures because anyone can claim to be Republican because you don't need to buy membership into a political party. So people could say that and say that, well, we're representative of a growing share of Republicans. But again, look at those polls that I've included in the show notes. Most Republicans, and again, increasingly independents, and even a smaller share, but growing share of Democrats say that they don't want to buy or never will consider an EV because of just the different unknowns and the problems associated with driving them. So let's not make opposition to EVs a partisan issue like these people are. But where he's getting this idea that this has to be a top campaign issue, I don't know anywhere where EVs are top of mind for people. I think opposition to EVs could be an actual more sellable campaign issue, speaking independently of any of my affiliations. But people are increasingly against net zero proposals, and EV mandates, directly and indirectly, are part of that net zero policy proposal, and more people are increasingly opposed to net zero energy policies because they see that they're far more cost prohibitive, they're more expensive, and you're not conserving any energy, and you're having fewer choices going forward. And you still will, ironically, have to use fossil fuels to power all these so-called net zero technologies. If you want to go down the rabbit hole of this new interesting group, I welcome you to do so. But again, EV opposition, not partisan. Republicans may have led the fight, but you're going to see more Americans, independents even, and even some Democrats say that charting down this course is not good. I think you're going to see independent opposition and even a lot of elected Democrats walk back EV mandates when they start to materialize and show that they're really bad or that fewer people naturally are buying EV cars. Now, two, genes being harmful to the environment. This is such an interesting story. And granted, this is a very clickbaity article. So this is from the New York Post, who is very different from the New York Times. And the New York Post, if you guys don't know, is under the same family of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. And sometimes they have some, you know, clickbaity, kind of questionable articles. Like sometimes the New York Post gets AR-15s and semi-automatic rifles wrong. Like they have some people who write about these type of firearms and they don't understand them, and they call for prohibitions in the past, absolutely. And so I have some qualms about some of their positions, but I think it's a generally good newspaper. But they have an article from a writer called Asia Grace, "Wearing Jeans is Bad for Earth," study finds, and yes, even just once. The writer cites a study claiming recent research from Guangdong University of Technology in China found that wearing a pair of fast fashion jeans just once creates a whopping 2.5 kilograms of carbon emissions. The environmental wear and tear of the pants is equivalent to driving 6.4 miles in an average gasoline-powered car. The report goes on to say, she includes quotes from the authors of the new report, "This study took jeans as an example to reveal the carbon footprint of fast fashion consumption and its additional climate impacts compared to traditional fashion." The report, they say, is set for publishing in May 2024. Jeans production and cross-broad transportation contributed 91% of the carbon footprint of fast fashion consumption, out of the experts. And they're just not pulling your leg. To determine the CO2 effect, scientists followed the life cycle of a pair of jeans that were quickly produced, shipped, worn, washed, and discarded after about 7 uses. I'm going to plead ignorance here. Maybe this is just me and who I surround myself with, but I don't partake in fast fashion. I don't believe in discarding clothes after singular uses. So I would like to know who these people are, because if they're doing this, aside from this kind of alarmist study, none of my friends engage in fast fashion. Any of your friends? I mean, I've heard that this is a problem and this is something I need to look into more. Honestly, I'm going to concede that point. But of course, they're going to make it about climate change and your footprint and all this. But I wager that most regular Americans are not discarding jeans after a singular use. Maybe a celebrity in Hollywood or some New York fashionista perhaps is, because they have disposable income and they don't like something or they're careless or whatever. But I think most Americans will wear jeans and delay washing them, you know, after a few uses. But I've been someone who keeps pairs of pants for several years, jeans in particular. I don't discard them after singular uses. I love good jeans. Like, I will wear jeans multiple days at a time. I will keep them for years at a time as long as there's no wear and tear. I'll keep t-shirts. So personally speaking, this doesn't apply to people like me. And I think I'm not alone in this type of behavior. I don't think most Americans, how can you afford to discard stuff? Clothing is more expensive, especially clothing that is produced here in the United States. Like, why would I discard something after several uses, unless if it got a bad tear or something that was irreparably damaged? That would be the only time I would discard something. So you can have a separate conversation about fast fashion, but do you do this through mandates? Do you do this voluntarily? How do you inspire people to change their behaviors without the force of government? So you can have a separate conversation and say, we can encourage people to change their habits going off of this. But they, in this article, continue that fast fashion finery emits ghastly amounts of greenhouse gases, which cause global warming and climate change into the atmosphere. And they claim that the study says that the industry is projected to emit nearly 2.8 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions annually by 2030. Traditional fashion, typically more pricey apparel made with high quality materials and environmental sustainability in mind, emits 0.22 kilograms of CO2 per the findings. Fast fashion produces 11 times more of the pollution due to hasty manufacture, international distribution via air travel, repeated washes, and swift trashing. But analysis say there's hope for Mother Earth yet. Product service systems could slow the rapid reduction in consumption cycles of fast fashion and help move fashion to a circular system by providing recycling, secondhand, and rental services, the study author said. If we want people to make more responsible, eco-conscious choices, they have to be done voluntarily and without shaming people. This is what marine biologist Wallace J. Nichols wrote in his fantastic book, The Blue Mind, which a lot of my friends have read at my insistence. He said that to inspire environmental change that is subsisting and persisting and lasts for a long time is you can't guilt people into living a certain lifestyle, and you can't overwhelm them with data or make them feel guilty. And that could be what happens here, because I think mandates are a terrible idea. You don't do that. It's not going to compel people to change behaviors. If you have regulations aimed squarely at fast fashion companies, who is to say that the government wouldn't extend hypothetical mandates and regulations to non-fast fashion companies? The law of unintended consequences plays into the role here as well. So this would affect, if there were to be regulation, I don't see it stopping at fast fashion companies. It could stop at other companies who are deemed to be too carbon intensive. Their services are carbon intensive. Their production side is too carbon intensive. We see this happening already. And so for me, as a natural skeptic, I don't think a mandate would work. I think just encouraging people to be more responsible, practical, and know that you can reuse stuff and don't have to discard things, I think that works great. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, a mandate here, if this is like teeing up a mandate, because we see these studies, these singular studies come out, and then regulators here in the United States use this as a template to say, you know what, let's take this idea and run with it. But again, law of unintended consequences, is this going to stop simply at fast fashion? No, this is going to be applied to, if there were to be hypothetical rulemaking, this is what I'm thinking, this would apply to other industries as well. And whatever can be deemed carbon intensive, they're going to look to scrutinize that and regulate that the most. So you want to compel people to be conscious and not waste. Just be nice about it. Don't mandate people to change and upend their lifestyles. Like, this is the same thing for red meat consumption, energy consumption. Mandates to restrict the use of jeans would be very unpopular, I have no doubt, much like it is to discourage consumption of red meat, energy, what have you. So voluntary action, draw awareness to fast fashion, absolutely. But couple it with a mandate from the government, not very conducive to free choice. And I think it'll have a negative reaction, negative impact, and actually lead to worsening of emissions. That's usually how these policies are. So that is my take on all these interesting trending topics, a little longer than usual, but I hope you found these topics to be compelling. If you listen to the end of the show, we have a great interview teed up for next week with a python huntress out of Florida. You ought to know. So you'll be able to look forward to that. And I will be filming in the Pacific Northwest for an upcoming episode of my Conservation Nation series. We're going to go into a deep dive on hydroelectric dams and why they are critical infrastructure projects in the region. Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners. And we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I am all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.